I mean, everyone always seems to like stories about, you know, famous experiments of the past. I think, like, and of course, Pavlov. Everyone knows about Pavlov.
I don't, but I think the name rings a bell. Hello, and welcome to the Intelligent Millennials podcast, where we got nothing figured out, but everything to say. The goal of this show is to have intelligent conversations with our guests, have fun, and hopefully drop a little bit of knowledge in the process. My name is Viet Nguyen. I'm the owner of the Intelligent Millennials blog, and today I'm also the host of the Intelligent Millennials podcast. You can find me on Twitter under the handle @VietPDX. Today I will be talking to John Cook, a friend of mine who also happens to have a bachelor's degree in psychology with a focus on behaviorism. Our conversation today takes a deep dive into psychology and why it's different from the harder sciences such as math, physics, or biology. We talk about behaviorism and how our lizard brain can often override our sense of reason and logic. We then start talking about how literally all of our decisions are affected by our lizard brains, from what we consume on television and social media to what we literally consume with our eating habits. Obviously, we also have thinking brains that help us to make rational, logical decisions, and, in a perfect world, we would always make the right choice. But oftentimes, appeals to emotions, bad habits, or just plain laziness gets in the way. We also talk about how we can train our lizard brains in order to overcome common logical fallacies and to fight things such as decision fatigue. There's a lot of psychological concepts and experiments that we mentioned, but we didn't have time to discuss them all in full detail. I'll be providing links to those studies in the footnotes. So, without further ado, let's get on to the show. Hey, John, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Viet.
Yeah, it's been a long time. We've come a long way. I remember working 10 years ago at a Radio Shack, and you were my boss. And you can't even imagine, that almost 10 years later, we're both married, we're both gainfully employed. We didn't go down with the ship at Radio Shack. We're both doing pretty interesting things, huh?
I would say so. It was 10 years ago. A lot can happen in 10 years.
I'm glad to hear that you're doing good. Congratulations on recently getting married.
Thank you. I don't know how I manage it. She's way above my league.
So let's go ahead and get with what I like to do at the beginning of the show is have a couple icebreaker questions, and they're designed for you to say whatever is on the top of your mind without thinking about it too much. So it's actually a pretty good primer for behaviorism. So you ready?
Well, let's do it.
All right. Question one. What's the last thing you Googled?
Last thing I Googled? I think it was doing research for this podcast, actually.
What's on your Spotify or Apple Music playlist?
Probably Portishead, Tool, Metallica.
You don't listen to 80s glam rock anymore?
That too, but not lately. I was going to say, you got to have hair to really appreciate the hair rock.
Okay, what have you been watching on Netflix lately?
Black Mirror.
What's something you think is underrated?
Thing I think is underrated? I'm going to go with genuine dialogue. And the reason I say that is I feel like for about 80% of the conversations that we have in the course of our day, a lot of the things that we say aren't meant to be meaningful, and they're almost kind of meant like pleasantries. Like when you say hi to someone, you ask how they are you really expecting a response?
I say, yeah, I'm doing good, how are you? And then I walk off and do whatever I want to do after that, right?
Yeah, pretty much. It's like having a password for the situation. The password is, I'm fine, how are you? I had an interaction with somebody at a coffee shop where they asked me how I was, and I said, oh, I'm fine. And they said, oh, hey, well, great, you know, what are you up to? And they had follow-up questions, and I was surprised at how surprised I was.
You know, there was a social experiment that anyone can do. I encourage all our listeners, all our, like, one listener, to do this if you can. What you do is you ask to cut in line at Starbucks and you make up whatever reason you want. And the game is the more absurd the reason, just to see if they'll just let you cut in line. Like, I know one guy said, oh yeah, can I cut in line? I have a Razor scooter. And before they even like think about it, like he's already like they already let him in. Like it's almost like you ask the question and then they already automatically go into like, oh, okay, sure, without even hearing it, because like the rational part of their brain hasn't turned on yet. So yeah, go ahead and give that a try, just as crazy of an excuse as you can. Sometimes it works too with a barista. Like you could ask for a discount and just say, oh yeah, could I get a discount? And you just say, whatever, I work at the mall here, can I get a discount? And it's too weird for them to say no, so they just go ahead and give you the discount anyways. But it's a cool little experiment.
And having worked at a few malls, that works as often as it doesn't.
And what do you have to lose? Like literally, well, there's literally nothing to lose in that situation. The worst they could say is no. You're no better off than you were before.
I mean, what are they going to say? No, in fact, I'm going to raise the price now?
Yeah, they're not going to say that. So pretty interesting things that we could do just to mess with people if you're into that kind of stuff. Last question. What's the best purchase that you've made recently that is under $100?
Best purchase for under $100? I got to go with, I have to go with noise-canceling headphones.
Any particular brand?
It was just some brand that I got off of Amazon. It wasn't a brand that I'd ever heard of, but they're awesome. It was like a lightning deal. It's so cool. I didn't realize how rare genuine silence is in the world until you put these on, you turn the noise canceling off, and you're just like, wow, all of a sudden it's easy to think.
Yeah, especially like I use them when I fly in an airplane. It doesn't cancel everything out, but like, you know, the sound of the fan and the sound of like just the general noise, it does really good at canceling that out, and it helps you like sleep and stuff.
And it's a great excuse to not talk to people.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so let's get into the topic. The main topic we're going to be talking about is psychology. I know that you have a degree in psychology with an emphasis on behaviorism. So is that like now you could psychoanalyze what I just told you and now you could figure out exactly what I'm going to do or if I'm going to murder people or not?
It's exactly like Law and Order, you know, where I can watch you order at Starbucks and I can read your Facebook feed and I instantly understand you in every meaningful way.
Why is that not true? Obviously, I was trolling. Like, why is it not something that you could do just by like talking to someone for 5 minutes? Like it isn't like Criminal Minds or whatever.
You know, it's really cool. And I wish that the depiction of psychological analysis that you see on like Law and Order or CSI was something that was actually viable, because if that was the case, there would be very little crime, because you could just take behaviors, put them through an algorithm, put it on Facebook, and just catch people. Unfortunately, it's not the case. The behaviors that people present you with are often not behaviors that are genuine, or the thoughts people present you with are often thoughts that are presented with the intent of being palatable. By the very nature of saying something that is not exactly what you mean, you make it difficult to be understood.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of filtering that goes on. Like, what I want to do one day at Facebook, if I were a programmer, is I would switch the search box with the update status box. So then they would just post whatever they're searching.
I think you are an unappreciated genius. I think that would be so enlightening.
Okay, so I know a little bit about psychology. I did take an intro psych class way back in the day, over 10 years ago. I know that there's three main kinds of psychology, and it's exactly what people think of the tropes. There's like the Freudian stuff where you sit in the chair and talk about your childhood. And then there's also the the trope of being in an insane asylum where everything is white and you're in a straitjacket and then people like shock your brains and stuff like that. The last one is the trope where you have like usually some German guy with like animals and stuff, and then they like shock them or do stuff to do like weird experiments. Is that accurate?
So you touched on a really great point, and I think this is something that a lot of people may not know about the field of psychology. Within the field of psychology, there isn't what you would call a unifying dogma. Like if you've ever studied biology, you find that the biology is a study of cellular life. The central dogma of biology is that heritable traits move from DNA to RNA to protein. And those are like rules that everybody who is a biologist or works in biology can get behind. In the field of psychology, that is not always the case. And the reason for that is because of what you just said, because you have these multiple kind of branches or schools of thought within psychology. You've got Freudianism, or now Neo-Freudianism, which is centered around the idea that the cause of many behaviors and thoughts originate in the subconscious or the unconscious. And it kind of bubbles out from the back of your mind that you're not aware of, and that's how some things happen, and sometimes you'll surprise yourself with your action. There is cognitive theory, and cognitive theory is sort of similar to behaviorism, in that it says that the steps of decision-making go through, and based on what happens before a behavior and what happens after a behavior, that will shape future behaviors. And then you've got humanism. Human beings are always trying to reach their maximum potential. And if you've ever seen that pyramid, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yes, I think I'm familiar with that. So like at the bottom is water, food, and then after you get the basic ones, like then accomplishment or being famous or something.
And as I like to say, you know, it's hard to worry about being respected if you can't breathe. But you start at the bottom and kind of work your way up based on the necessity of things. So that's kind of what humanism is all about. Behaviorism now tends to be called behavior analysis, which is the idea that all behaviors are based on a history of stimuli which reinforces or punishes.
The problem here is that all these three schools of thought are saying all different things, and depending on kind of what you believe, you could interpret the information in a lot of different ways. Is that correct?
Yes, that is very correct.
What you're studying behaviorism, it's almost like, look, we don't care what happens inside the brain. We can only measure and control what we see outside, like what a person does. And then that's what we're going to work with.
Yeah, that is totally right. And that's actually why I chose behaviorism, is because as a scientific-minded person, it was really hard to reconcile being interested in cause and effect and being able to disprove theories with something like Neo-Freudianism, forgive me for naming names, where it's impossible to have proof.
Let's go into what a typical study in behaviorism would be. So you mentioned here a Skinner box. Tell me what a Skinner box is.
A Skinner box is the device created by Dr. B.F. Skinner, who is the one who kind of popularized behaviorism. From his point on, he began referring to it as behavior analysis. So behavior analysis, kind of people coming after him kind of benefited from all the stuff that he did. He kind of revolutionized the whole behaviorism front. And the Skinner box is one of his inventions, which is essentially kind of imagine like a terrarium. And within this terrarium, it has the hardware required to modify everything about its interior. You modify temperature, humidity, light levels, sound levels, and you would put in there typically an experimental animal. Once within this, you can control everything about his environment, which is very important for the accuracy of a behavioral study. You want to be able to control the environment exactly so you know what change in stimuli is provoking any change in behavior.
What I'm imagining, and what I think a lot of people are imagining, is like a rat with like a button that it pushes so like food comes out or something, right?
Yeah, that is a really classic one, yeah. Another equally common one is a rat that can push a button to stop an aversive stimuli. Like, you know, we have a rat who's in this terrarium and he's chilling out, and every once in a while at random, a buzzer goes off and it's really annoying sounding, but he can turn the buzzer off by pushing the lever.
Obviously, those are animals and those are rats. What kind of conclusions was the Skinner guy trying to get to?
Skinner's big push was to bring psychology into the realm of the testable and the scientifically validatable. And what he was trying to show, essentially, is that you don't need to have a window into the mind as far as looking at like thoughts and emotions to be able to predict behaviors or to change behaviors. And that is true whether you're discussing a small like rodent in a Skinner box, or if you're discussing, I don't know, like a horse that's being trained by the circus, or if you're discussing a person living their life. The principles are all really similar.
So the conclusion here is that humans are basically the same as animals when it comes to the decision making. That kind of makes me a little bit uncomfortable.
I get that. It is kind of a strange idea.
It almost sounds like we're like machines made out of meat that react to stimuli. And obviously that makes a lot of people feel like, you know what, that's fake news. Like, I don't really think so.
You know, I get that because there's an idea that if you can change someone's actions just by changing their environment, that somehow violates the human spirit, or perhaps it violates human dignity. I actually do not agree with that. Skinner one time had a really great quote when he was discussing reinforcing people, and he basically said, people tend to do what works best. That's basically all it is. When you're modifying someone's behavior based on some kind of a stimuli that you're providing or you're withholding, is you're just changing the playing field so that a different behavior makes more sense than their current behavior. Like, as an example, you've got a kid who is, he's being disobedient. And a lot of people out there have kids who might have this problem where you have a child that is disobedient, or he's not obeying some rule that you have in your house that you think is necessary. Let's say he's breaking curfew. You think to yourself, well, gee, I wish my kid wouldn't break curfew. How can I change that behavior? And a lot of us right now, with very little knowledge of behaviorism or psychology, might just say, well, if he keeps breaking curfew, then I'm going to ground him. Right there, by you doing that, you have initiated this behavior controlling system in your own mind immediately, and you're putting it into effect. You're saying to your child, if you do this thing, this behavior that I don't want you to do, which is going out past curfew, I am going to withhold this reinforcer that you would like to receive, which is going out at all.
Without even knowing it, people have already internalized this concept of behaviorism in a Skinner box, basically. You live in my house, you live by my rules. That means that we could actually use this to reinforce good habits for ourselves and also the people around us.
In fact, it's funny how effective it is when you reinforce yourself for good behaviors.
So on the flip side, how does it affect your view of bad things such as addiction?
That is sort of tough. Things like someone who has an addiction to a chemical substance, or someone who has, let's say, a predisposition to lose their temper. Some of that is likely based upon a history of being reinforced or being punished. You know, our lives are long. Human beings oftentimes will live, 100 years or maybe a little bit less than that. That's a long time to be learning about the world around you, and you'll find out what rewards you and what doesn't. So there is a history to a lot of people who have addiction problems or anger management issues or what have you, of being rewarded for that by their surroundings. There's also an aspect of biology in that. Some of us are just more prone to addictive type behaviors. And some people are more open to the concept of violent behavior than others. And those are differences at the level of the person that can't be accounted for by behaviorism itself. It's like a preponderance toward a behavior.
So basically, what's happening is there's a whole lifetime in reinforced behavior when it comes to something like alcohol or drugs or anger. It's not a simple fix as doing something real quick and then deprogramming that. That is to say, it's going to take time to deprogram someone if they have a disposition to rage or substance abuse. Is that correct?
Let's say you have a history where, let's just pick a subject at random. Let's say that you have difficulty managing your anger, and you have someone in your life who allows you to be that way, or who will make excuses for you, or who will cover for you when you act out. That probably means that you have a history of being able to behave in this manner and experience minimal negative consequences.
That is to say, you're being enabled. There's an enabler in your life.
If you were to ask a behaviorist, they would say that means that you can act in a way that reinforces you, that makes you feel good, makes you more likely to repeat the behavior, and there's minimal reasons for you to stop. And if you have a history of that, it's going to take an equal history of having more reasons to stop than to continue.
A friend of mine, and he's like a salesman, like he likes to sell lots of things. And so salesmen have like their own like psychology books. And what they talk about is your lizard brain and then your actual rational brain. So when we're talking about behaviorism, we're not necessarily talking about the part that thinks. We're talking about that lizard parts where it does react to certain stimuli. So even though you know that you have a rage issue or an alcohol issue, you know in your like higher functioning part, you're not supposed to do it. But I think that as far as the salesman guy goes and as far as a behaviorist goes, they're not concerned about the rational part of the brain, the higher functioning stuff. When something happens, then you're already into that mode, like chemically or physiologically going into a rage, or you're already physiologically wanting to get to whatever it is that, you know, makes you feel better, whether it be substance abuse or alcohol or anything like that.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think we've all been there. If you've ever been in a rage, you understand that the higher parts of your brain, like the neurons in your cortex that make us the brilliant animals that we are, sort of turn off.
Yeah, so it's more like we have to train that lizard part of our brain if we want to undo a particular thing. And that, I think that's the hardest thing to rationalize there. And then the thing, and now I mentioned here in our notes that we have a thin veneer of rationality that's like right above our lizard brain. And I think that's pretty much true. I think that our impulses and how we feel about things control us more than we like to think.
When we are affected at a lower level, like say at an emotional level versus at an intellectual level, it might be more difficult for us to detect. I don't know. Maybe it's less obvious to us somehow. Like if you were to sit down with me at a table with me with a sheet of numbers and show me why I should buy a certain car. You know, here's the gas mileage and here's the average cost per year to maintain the car, and show me a number in green that says this is the number, the amount of money that you'll save, you should buy this car. I would say, okay, well, you know, thanks, that's really smart, I'll think about that. But if you were to show me like a TV commercial, like driving on like a sunny seacoast, you know, like the top down and like a hot girl sitting next to me and like the radio's on, that is a different sort of evidence.
It's an appeal to your lizard brain, basically.
Yes, and because there's no real argument, it's harder to dispute.
There is another term that I did not tell you that we were going to talk about, but I'm just going to say it. But there's a term, cognitive dissonance. So what that is that your rational brain is really, really, really good at making excuses for decisions that you've already made on your lizard side.
Absolutely. That is one of those terms that if you take psychology classes, you will hear.
Yeah, and that's even the worst part, because we're constantly making excuses for ourselves. So it's like, well, I had a rough day at work, I deserve to treat myself, and then you go ahead and get another drink, or you do the thing that makes you feel better. What's the term, self?
If you were in medicine, you say you're self-medicating.
There we go. Yeah, that's the term, self-medicating.
But you're also self-reinforcing when you do that.
We see this stuff happen all the time. We're going to talk about generalization now. Salesmen know about this. Parents know about this. Who else can take advantage of this behaviorism?
Generalization is a really interesting tool because it allows you to make lots of judgments very quickly. And it's a great way to sort of train a behavior without having to train every single target of that behavior.
Okay, so yeah, it's like that one experiment that we just talked about. The experiment with that little kid who was in that room, and the scientists came and like banged on a bunch of bells and things when they saw like a little white rat, and he freaked out. And then it generalized to the point where anything that was white would induce like a freak out mode in a little kid.
And that's actually a really great point. If you can condition a response and then generalize that response, it's as if you conditioned a whole bunch of individual responses. I was just going to say, I mean, and so, to an extent that's great, but to another extent that can sort of border on the cruel, especially if you're doing things like Watson did with Little Albert.
So how does the world manipulate us without us even knowing it?
Smartphone app manufacturers are extremely involved in the behaviorist process. There's a lot of reinforcement happening in a lot of phone apps that I've seen. I feel like that the behaviorist approach to human psychology works really well for phone app manufacturers, because it doesn't really require an understanding of one's internal intellectual landscape. Like, I don't need to know a lot about your history, for example, as long as I can rely on a few things that reinforce you. And you'll see it in a lot of phone apps. You know, there's lots of bright colors and lots of fast movement and interesting things. And, like, there's lots of opportunities to be successful with relatively little effort. What they're doing there, you open up your phone app and you're playing your game. You know, you're playing the Clash of Kings, and a bunch of different games that I see where it's like you're like a huge fighting scenario, and there's lots of victory to be had, which is very reinforcing.
What basically this is like an electronic Skinner box, because these developers have access to literally millions of phones, and they could see exactly when someone starts and when someone ends, and what makes them quit and what makes them stay. Is that correct? And then they could tweak their code almost in real time to keep people on the app, because if the longer they're on the app, the more they make money, right?
I mean, there's a really great quote that I like, which is, if you are engaging in some pastime for free, you are the product.
So what's that have to say about social media and things like that too?
So if you're using a free platform like Facebook, or if you're on a free phone app, or if you're on social media and you're doing things and you're not paying any money, it's because you are not the customer. You are the product. And the product that you are providing is your time and attention. And that's usually measured in clicks. The game really is, whether it's with Facebook or with a phone app, is to keep you engaged as long as possible and to get you clicking on as much content as possible.
Yeah, I've seen games that actually don't even hide this fact. They will say that this game is legit really addictive, like it's a good thing. There's ulterior motives there, obviously.
Which would be kind of like advertising a cigarette saying, guys, seriously, this is the most nicotine I've ever seen in a cigarette. You should buy this. So I feel like there is a slight disconnect between the common parlance and clinical parlance of what addictive means. In clinical language, if you were to say, oh, this thing is very addictive, they'd say, well, then why are you doing it? But you know that's addictive. That's more of a pathology than it is a desirable trait. I have multiple friends who will tell me they didn't do something because they have ADD. I know them personally. They are not afflicted with attention deficit disorder. It's a popular parlance. It just means I got distracted.
Yeah, it's actually something that someone has to take medicine for. It's a physiological disorder. And when you're using it like, oh, well, I was on Reddit. Sorry, I had ADD. It's almost like you're minimalizing what actual people with ADD have. Yeah, it's not a good habit that people get into. Also, when people say, oh, I'm really OCD about my clothes, I have to get them folded. Well, no, you just really care about having clean clothes. You don't actually take like medicine to treat your disorder, like as a physiological, psychological disorder.
Right. Like, oh, so you have OCD about your clothes. So if your clothes aren't folded, you just can't leave the house?
No, I was just saying that, like, I like having them folded because otherwise I get mad. So that's not OCD.
And that's the thing. People say, oh, I'm really OCD. I have to have my things just so. And so it's like, oh, so you're really OCD. So if your clothes are folded, you have to check to make sure they're folded 5 times. One of those things where there's 2 different uses.
Okay, so let's pivot back to these online Skinner boxes, a.k.a. games like, you said, Clash of Clans.
The Clash of Clans, thank you.
Clash of Clans, Candy Crush, things like that. I know that there are other... I did some research with the Skinner boxes, and this also applies to slot machines. They found that if a rat knew to push a button and a thing of food came out, it would only push it when it needed food. It just knew. Just like when you're hungry, you order something from Uber Eats and it comes and then you're done, you're full. But something that was really weird that they discovered is that if they program the lever, that if it comes out, you have a chance of something coming out, but a chance of something not coming out, then it causes, well, I'll let you explain. What would the rat do at that point when it's trained with stimuli like that?
So if you have a situation where it's a variable interval, which is there's a random amount of time it will take to dispense the pellet, that rat is just going to push that pellet paddle over and over and over again. And he's going to push the paddle over and over and over again. That is probably the most addictive reinforcement schedule you can have an organism on is variable interval.
And then with this amount of data that they get for the rat, they could find out the exact interval of time and instances to get it to be the most compulsive as possible. Is that correct?
So you have to be careful about that. If you go too long without reinforcing, you will begin to what they call extinguish the behavior, which basically means that it's been so long since you were reinforced that you go, oh, maybe I was wrong. Maybe this isn't going to create a cool outcome for me. I should stop.
We have so many people, like, for example, on what's the new game that came out? Like Star Wars Battlefront 2. People complain that you've already bought the stupid game for like $80. And then now you have to pay for more add-ons. The frustrating thing is that you don't actually get to buy the add-ons you want. You have to buy these loot boxes, and these loot boxes don't come with the thing that you want. It's like a surprise. Do you think behaviorism has a role in that?
Absolutely. I think it would be really hard to not see the role in that. It would sort of be like the old shell game where the guy has three different shells, and it's the exact same as like buying a loot box. If you buy a loot box and get something cool every single time, you go, okay, sweet. And then if you stop getting cool things, you just stop and go, okay, never mind, I guess the well ran dry. But if you only get reinforced every once in a while, if you don't get something cool, you go, oh, well, you know, that's just the odds. I'll try again. And you'll keep going long after another person on a different reinforcement schedule had been extinguished. So long after someone else would have stopped trying, you continue to try because this could be the time.
People can complain about it, but the executives in the suits, they can see the data, and the data doesn't lie to them. People are going to still buy those loot boxes anyways. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely.
They have people who are hired psychologists who literally can game all your behaviors and have all of your lizard brain things work against you as much as you want to complain about it with your rational mind, right?
And if you want proof that your thinking does not make you immune to that, just look at the fact that, you know, there's many people who are quite intelligent who fall for the kind of stuff all the time.
Back to like social media and Facebook, what do you think about those platforms? How do they get us addicted? How did it keep us addicted?
What Facebook is doing is reinforcing you, and there's rules involved in making a reinforcer good, and a really important rule is immediacy. As soon as you perform an action, boom, there should be your reinforcement or your little reward right there. And that's why that's one of the places where Facebook really shines, is that you have it on your phone. You put something on Facebook, you post a comment, or you post a picture, people comment on it, boom, it's an immediate reinforcer.
My Facebook, I like cats and like puppies, so I hit the like button, right? And so Facebook automatically, in its like algorithms or something, sends me more pictures of cats.
The more of that you see, like, you know, you love pictures of cats. You see a picture of a cat. Oh, I like that. There, you're reinforced. And you click like because you liked it. You see another one, you're reinforced. So you click it again. And we've all been in this loop. Next thing you know, you're like, how have I been online for an hour?
So basically what we're doing is we are in our own Skinner box and we are kind of designing our own inputs. That's what Facebook is doing to us.
Based on that, as long as you're being reinforced, you're going to continue until you get satiated.
Yeah, and so the dangerous part, I think, is that if I hit a button and a slice of pizza comes out, you know, like I can eat four or five slices of pizza, or maybe like a lot more slices of pizza than other people. There comes to be a point where I'm done and I don't need any more pizza. But with social media, but with games, there's nothing in my brain telling me that I'm full. I can continually take in positive stimuli, whether it's healthy for me or not. That's a scary part.
That is a really great point, actually. So there's primary reinforcers, which are things that no one ever had to tell you that you wanted, like food or shelter or like a comfortable temperature. And then there are generalized reinforcers, and that is sort of like a token system, kind of like going to an arcade and getting tickets. And that is what Facebook does, is they are a generalized reinforcer.
I specifically stay away from people who post things that can be political or white supremacist or whatnot. The nefarious thing about Facebook is that, you know, I like puppies and kittens, but there's an alarming statistic out there that a lot of people actually get their primary news from their Facebook feed. How dangerous is that?
That is incredibly dangerous, in my opinion. Because you're getting your news, which I think when we hear the word news, we imagine, you know, what's going on in the world, an objective look at our surroundings. You are getting the objective, air quotes, look at your world around you from an entity that is attempting to show you what you want to see. Because when it shows you what you want to see, you will reward it by clicking on it and giving them revenue, because they can show you more ads if you click on more pages. In your attempt to see an unbiased view of the world around you, you are essentially clicking on things that Facebook shows you, which will teach them the things that they need to show you to get you to click on more things. And in the end, it's sort of a spiral where the more things that you want to see, the more you will look at. And that becomes your concept of what news is. That's not what news is. News isn't what you want to see. News is hopefully unbiased.
Hopefully you had to deal with whatever is presented to you in a rational way.
And there's, I think, a great number of people who use Facebook and even who use the internet in general who aren't aware of that digital bubble effect.
Yeah, and I don't know if the people in the media discovered this or researched this. I have a feeling that they just like stumbled upon it. But now they're competing with so much. They have to sell something that will get your eyeballs to pay attention and to click. They clearly have a sort of an agenda. And what I've heard from just what I've been reading is people who read the news, they read the news for two reasons. Number one, they want affirmation. So basically, they want to hear Anderson Cooper or whoever kind of say something that they agree with because that makes them feel a little bit better. And that's kind of a reinforcing thing. Or they rage watch. Have you ever heard of rage watching?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so they'll watch like Sean Hannity or something that is clearly against what they believe in just so they could get angry. And I think that might feed their rage addiction.
And I mean, that's one of those things where you would think, why would someone do something that only makes them angry? Watching the news just so you can get angry is kind of like playing a really difficult video game, even though it makes you angry. But you do it and it makes you really mad, but you don't stop. You keep going because even though that makes you mad, you were more rewarded than you were mad and you come back. I feel like it's the same way with a lot of news and a lot of politics, especially lately, where people will watch news articles and they'll say, oh, this person said that. That doesn't make any sense to me. What an idiot they are. And you get mad. But then you think to yourself, I sure am glad that I'm smarter than that person.
Tell me about confirmation bias and how that affects us.
Confirmation bias is essentially this idea that when you have your mind made up about something and you look at the evidence that is presented to you, you will tend to see supporting evidence for your own point.
So people are basically taking out what they want out of it and filtering out all the stuff that doesn't make sense in their brains, right?
Right. So you tend to see things and remember things more quickly and more clearly that do support your argument, and people will tend to forget about or discount things that don't agree with their argument. And this is not something that happens because you are an unfair person or because you are wanting to be biased. It happens automatically.
Yeah, and I feel like the news outlets kind of understand that as well. And when you watch a show like, I don't know, like, have you seen like Jimmy Kimmel? You know that guy, right? Like the show that he has late night.
Oh, yeah.
What he does is he goes out to the street and he interviews random people. And then, you know, they ask a basic question. But then the bit shows how stupid Americans are. And then just like the entire point of it is like, look how dumb we are, right? But I think with confirmation bias and all those psychological things working for us or against us, it's a numbers game. Like, they're going to go out and interview like 300 people. And then the five dumbos or like the 10 people who are just idiots, they're only going to show those 10 idiots. Then you generalize, oh, well, that's how all stupid Americans are or whatever. And that's what happens with basically any news outlet or basically any TV show.
I agree with that.
These outlets out there, no matter what you believe, they all do the same thing and they don't actually need to make anything up. You know, watch something like Rush Limbaugh. He's going to go ahead and read the news and there's bound to be like some PETA group out there in San Francisco who, instead of killing rats, they like capture them and then like release them outside of the city because they are so concerned about their life. And then Rush Limbaugh will just say, look how stupid these liberals are. Like, they don't have any common sense.
Right.
And then on the other side, you could watch something like The Daily Show or whatever. And they go ahead and take clips from Fox News of whatever pundit saying something stupid. And then they clip it all together and edit it and make it look funny. And at the same time, they're going to make fun of like, well, look at how these guys and how they don't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's confirmation bias on both ends of the spectrum there.
Absolutely. And that's not on accident. As we were saying, I mean, just like Facebook or just like any kind of a digital interactive media, they know what they're doing. They know that if you see that will confirm your beliefs on a subject, you will feel rewarded and you're likely to repeat the behavior. And the behavior, of course, is watching their show.
So don't you think that's a little bit selfish and narcissistic?
It sort of is, but it's really hard to say because I think you know as well as anyone. Yeah, I mean, right now it's like it's an arms race. Whether, you know, it's politically or whether it's news related or anything. It's a matter of, you know, how much can you get across how fast before you lose your audience. And I think a lot of us feel like the opportunity for real dialogue and rational critical thinking is just almost non-existent now. As far as the news goes, as far as politics goes, it's all about scoring points. I got to get in here, I got to make a good point, and then I got to withdraw. Unfortunately, it's the opposite of unbiased information. It's also the opposite of dialogue. But I feel like that's what people are really responding to lately. They want to see their opinions validated, and they want to see their viewpoint supported, and they want to see whoever they think of as the out-group denigrated, and they'll feel fully satisfied. They'll feel like they've been reinforced.
And what about the phenomena where you hear something, you're back to the rage watching, where you hear and you're presented with information that goes against what you believe personally? What happens to a person when they get information counter to their belief system?
So that's right back to cognitive dissonance. Depending on what the information is, if the information can be discounted, oftentimes it will be. And that, again, is not because someone is trying to be biased. It's just because when you have a conclusion in your mind and you see contrary evidence, many people's first reaction is to say, well, that can't be right. Because if you are confronted with evidence that shows that you have been incorrect, that state of cognitive dissonance occurs, where you find yourself performing in a way that is different from your belief system, and that's extremely uncomfortable. And I feel like that's probably the main reason for the kind of warm blanket feeling a lot of us get from seeing our beliefs echoed to us from TV and from the internet, is it saves us from that cold grip of that cognitive dissonance where you're going, oh, wait, have I been wrong this whole time?
There's another, it's not really a psychological thing. It's more like, I think it's a logical...
A fallacy?
It's a logical fallacy, correct. Where you start going with ad hominem attacks, where not only do you disagree with the other person's politics, you also can't help but make fun of the fact that they're fat or they're ugly. Someone from the other side, they're not just hearing what they think is wrong, they're also hearing that they're dumb, they're uneducated, they're fat, and they're ugly. Even if you presented me with information that is correct objectively, but you also slip in a couple jabs there talking about how dumb I am, it's not going to make me believe what you have to say. It's actually just going to turn me off and get more defensive.
Well, as of course it should. I mean, I don't know anyone who would tell you with a straight face, oh yeah, if I insult you, you'll see my point of view.
Yeah, that's exactly what we see in the news, though. Like, the late night hosts like Seth Meyers or whatever, like, they can't help but jab a thing in there where you could get we could score points with your audience, but at the same time, you're also alienating the people that you want them to turn around to see your point of view, and you're making it that much harder for them by being a jerk.
There was a study that was done back in the 60s, I believe. They had individual people sit down in a room by themselves, and they were given two different viewpoints on an issue of the time. And, you know, being that it was the 60s / maybe 70s, I'm sure they were talking about Watergate, you know, and stuff like that. They had, you know, here's an issue, and here's two different viewpoints. And the assignment for the subject of the experiment was to write down which of the two viewpoints they subscribed to, which of the two viewpoints they thought the majority subscribed to, and then write down some traits they thought went with people who had subscribed to both viewpoints. Let's say that I think that there should be a law that says that you must leave your car at home at least one day a week and bike to work. So that way we can reduce air pollution, you know, and save congestion on the road and so on and so forth. It'll be great. That should be a law. And let's say that I agree with that. I would say, well, I think people who agree with this are people who care about the earth and who are conscientious and who are in good physical shape. And I think people who don't agree with that are people who are in poor physical shape and just don't care. They found that people tended to believe that the majority agreed with what they agree with. When giving descriptors, they tended to describe people who thought as they did in positive terms and people who did not think as they did in negative terms. And that's really kind of the foundation for a lot of the knowledge that psychologists have on in-group and out-group biases.
So how do we fight this phenomena?
My favorite technique as far as that goes is get a subject that get a subject that you're absolutely comfortable with and you know that you're right, 100%. Go and make a genuine effort to research the contrary belief. Don't just, you know, go and look online at whoever is yelling the loudest about the subject, because that's going to infuriate you. Find someone who's discussing it and who's being reasonable, and do a job researching it almost like you wanted to explain that opponent's point of view to someone. Once you have an understanding of the opposition to what you believe, write down some good points. Make an effort in your mind to think to yourself, okay, this, I can see why this person believes this way. And not just in a derogatory, oh, because he's dumb. But no, I see the points here that make sense. I see there's defensible concepts here.
Like how the earth is round?
Yeah, and incidentally, just because you brought this up, I think it's hilarious. There was a blurb on the Flat Earth Society website bragging about how they have members all over the globe.
I don't know if they're real or if they're trolling. I just have this feeling that at the end of like 2020 or something, they're going to be like, oh yeah, we just did this to get a rise out of you. And they make you like triggered. That, or maybe they're sincerely, like if they're sincerely believing that the earth is flat, then more power to them, you know?
I guess, I mean, that's some pretty strong belief in the face of a lot of contrary evidence. Some arguments can be really hard to do that with. Like the flat earth argument, you can look at that and go, okay, I'm going to need a lot of conspiracy theory to get past a lot of the, you know, NASA footage, satellite probe footage, astronaut testimony, the simple fact that the sun casts shadows.
So there's another logical fallacy that I also forgot to mention in the show notes, but I think you touched upon it, the straw man fallacy, where what happens is you have what you believe, and then you really don't know what the other people believe. For example, Obamacare. If you believe Obamacare is a law that's beneficial, then what you're going to believe the other side is that they want us to die. They want to take Medicare from my grandma and they want to pull the plug on her because they just care about saving money or whatever, right? So obviously no Republican and no conservative wants to kill your grandma, but that's the argument. That's a narrative that you have in your brain. That's a straw man argument. The other side of it is insurance companies make a lot of money. So why would we need the government to mandate them to make even more money? Like, it's something that they should be able to handle themselves. And the straw man argument there on the other side is that, well, yeah, they want the government to control you because then it's easier for them to do what they want. And we just have a natural distrust of the government. And obviously, that's not what someone on the left or an Obamacare supporter thinks. But it's easy to knock down the straw man, to burn them down, right? So what you're describing is steel manning, where you have your belief, but then you go ahead and research the other side and actually come up with actual, like, legit reasons for them to believe what they believe, and you try to kind of attack your own position.
Yes, and that is such a good thing to do. I mean, if you want to make sure that you haven't just been caught in a confirmational loop of everything you see online telling you that you're right, yeah, research the opposition and look at, you know, if I was to make a case for this, could it be done? What you were saying earlier, kind of the straw man of this, liberals just want the government to have full control over your health care.
Obama's going to pull the plug on your grandma.
I'm sure Obama wants your grandma to have a long, happy life, right? Nobody wants your grandma to die, and nobody wants the government to control your health care outcomes. This is absurd. Like, no real person thinks this. And that's not just in the straw man argument. That's actually a thing in a lot of debate circles. The argument to the absurd or something like that?
Yeah, absurdium, I think. Something absurdium.
You think that we should leave our cars at home because it's causing too much pollution, so you think we shouldn't drive at all, we're going to send us back to the Stone Age. Is that what you want?
I think the imagery, you're kind of hacking the lizard brain again, and you're bringing imagery, and obviously imagery is way easier to identify with, and it's harder to argue against when you have an image or an emotion of something. There is a book that a lot of people are familiar with, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. One of the chapters reads, in order to be understood, you must first seek to understand the other person. We're not going to change each other's opinion in one conversation or whatnot. And in fact, that shouldn't even be the goal of reading or looking and or engaging with another person. But the goal really is just to understand where they're coming from.
Right. That's so important. I'm not even sure what the point would be in conversing with someone that you don't want to understand. From a behavior analysis standpoint, you can't help someone modify a behavior if you don't understand the person. I mean, there are some universal reinforcers, and there are some universal aversive stimuli. So I guess you could technically say, oh, well, you know, I'm going to hit you with cold water and make a loud noise if you do this thing. I don't know you, but I bet you don't like that.
I thought that was the ice bucket challenge.
I will force you to do the ice bucket challenge.
After talking to you for about an hour and a half almost now, I think the most interesting part was about how we have our behavioral brain that's reactive. It's more reactive than anything else. And what stimuli we feed it to get it to react. And then we have our rational brain who is not as strong as we think it is. I think our willpower comes from our rational brain. Or you have a limited supply of willpower. And if you don't change the underlying lizard brain, then you're gonna lose the lizard brain every single time.
And you've probably read the studies people have done on, was it like cognitive fatigue or decision-making fatigue?
Yeah, decision fatigue.
Yeah, that's your cognitive brain, logical brain, after a while just running out of juice.
For example, when it's at the end of the day and you haven't made anything for dinner, you just go like, I don't care. I'm just going to go to Safeway and I'll just get the first thing I see at like the Chinese kitchen. I was trying to do sit-ups and I was trying to eat like broccoli and stuff, but it's too much work at this point. I deserve this. I worked a long day. I'm just going to go get whatever. I don't care.
I hear that expression all the time from people prior to them saying they're going to do something that they otherwise would find unacceptable. I deserve this.
And that's just your lizard brain coming out there at that point.
Pretty much. It's like, well, you know what? I feel like I want this, so I'm going to do it.
A guy that I follow, his name is Scott Adams. He's the guy who created Dilbert.
Oh, nice.
He says that he prefers systems rather than goals. Because what's your goal? Like, let's say my goal is to drop 10 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do after that goal is complete? So either one, you reach your goal and then you're not quite sure what you have beyond that. Or two, you don't reach your goal and you feel bad about yourself. And either way, you don't have anything beyond that. If you have a system where it's like, well, my system is I'm going to avoid eating bread. Like if I see a burger, I'm going to eat the burger and I'm going to get the lettuce wrap instead of the bread. And in that way, you're not tied to losing 10 pounds as your goal. It's just you have a system, and then losing 10 pounds is just going to be a side effect of that system. And then in that way, you're not using your rational brain as much. You're just programming your lizard brain to kind of do stuff automatically without engaging willpower at that point. You already have a system in place. Obviously, that's like a really small system, but you could do a lot of things just like that to reduce the amount of thinking that you have to do. Like the less you have to think and the more you automate, the better you are for it. And that's kind of hacking your behavioral psychology to your own benefit.
That is so right on, actually. Yeah, the less you have to think about stuff, the better your chances are of doing all the things you were going to do.
That was very informative this evening. Thank you for sharing your knowledge with us about behavioral psychology. Are you ready for the speed round?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, Marvel or DC?
Marvel.
Apple or Android?
Android.
If you could have one type of candy for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Oh, man. Candy? York peppermint patties.
What's one thing people should be doing right now but aren't?
Go down to your local hospital and let them know that you want to volunteer. Or go to your local VA and tell them that you want to volunteer. The state of those who need psychological help right now is often the state of those who are underserved. A lot of people who are in dire economic straits or have real problems with their lifestyle or who live in a dysfunctional way have psychological impairments and have difficulty managing their own affairs. If you want and you have time, go and volunteer at a hospital, volunteer at a shelter or a veterans organization. You will probably, if you're like me, find it incredibly rewarding. And you're going to learn a lot about psychology and a lot about people, too.
Well, that's our show today. John, where can we find out about volunteering?
If you're local to Portland, the organization that I advocate for is Portland Homeless Family Solutions. And you can look them up. They have a internet presence, and they're based out of the Goose Hollow district of Portland. And wherever you are, if that's not local to you, just, you know, go on the internet and do a search. You can find places that provide good services to people in the area, and you will learn a lot about psychology dealing with people who are underserved. And you're going to feel great doing it.
Well, that's the show for today. Thank you for joining us on the Intelligent Millennials podcast. After talking about how dangerous social media can be, it's unsurprising to learn that John does not have a social media presence. Instead, you could probably find him helping out the homeless at the Goose Hollow district in Portland. If you're interested in the work that John is involved in, you could look up the Portland Homeless Family Solutions at pdxhfs.org. Again, references to all the things we talked about will be listed in the show notes. If you like the show, remember to rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Google, or Stitcher. Also, please let me know what you think of the episode, what you liked and what you didn't like, so we can continue to improve. And as always, stay intelligent.